Hi, I'm Tess Vigeland. It took them long enough, but the Fed drew up regulations this week that get rid of some bad mortgage lending practices, like this one.
One thing they're going to do is they're going to outlaw something that's been called a liar loan.
That's reporter Nancy Marshall-Genzer with this week's Marketplace Money Inside Quote. Liar loans have been blamed for some of the subprime mortgage mess. Now riddle me this, what are they? Perhaps they're A, loans that let the borrower declare income without having to provide proof. Or are they B, loans banks market to borrowers without telling them the rates will skyrocket in a few years? Or is it C, a con where you fork over a down payment and then the lender disappears? Here's the honest truth. The answer is coming up on Marketplace Money from American Public Media. From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, this is Marketplace Money. Making a list, checking it twice. Does it have your FICO score? Because from here on out, you'll need it to get a mortgage. I'm Tess Vigeland. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, working to provide tools and expertise to help you meet your retirement goals and ultimately thrive in retirement. Let's thrive. On the web at thrivent.com/retirement.
We had a small and probably short-lived reprieve from the dismal housing news this week. Foreclosure filings actually fell in November. Small comfort for anyone in Stockton, California, where the foreclosure rate is the highest in the nation at 1 in every 99 homes. President Bush signed a bill with relief for homeowners who are able to do a short sale. They will no longer owe taxes on the mortgage debt that is forgiven as part of that transaction. And the Federal Reserve stepped in with proposals for a crackdown on some of the shady lending that helped create the mortgage crisis. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer joins us from Washington to break it all down. Hey, Nancy.
Hello, Tess.
So what did the Fed exactly propose in terms of cracking down on lending practices?
Well, Tess, one thing they're going to do is they're going to outlaw something that's been called a liar loan. Tess, you could actually sit down with a loan officer and say, without any documentation, I'm Tess Vigeland. I make $500,000. They wouldn't require any proof of that. So that's no longer going to be allowed. Also, lenders are going to be prohibited from engaging in a pattern of lending to borrowers who cannot afford to pay a loan at its higher rate. That seems to be pretty much common sense. If the borrower can't afford to pay, then you shouldn't give them the loan. Also, one thing that they're doing is they're going to sort of crack down on prepayment penalties, but they're not going to ban them altogether. This is where, Tess, you got this loan. You don't make $500,000 a year. Let's be honest. So you go out, you get that lower interest rate loan. You pay off the first one that you lied to get, and they penalize you for that by thousands of dollars. Now, they're still going to be allowed to do that, but you're going to have about a two-month window where you can prepay that expensive loan you lied to get, and you won't be penalized for it. But it's only a two-month window.
Does this do anything to help those who are already facing foreclosure?
No, ma'am, it doesn't. This only applies to new loans.
What kind of other proposals are out there to deal with the lending industry? I already saw this week that a lot of folks are saying the Fed action is way too little too late.
Yeah, and some members of Congress are saying that. One thing, members of Congress, especially Democrats, are very upset about this prepayment issue. They think that prepayment penalties should be banned altogether. And I want to read you one choice quote from Barney Frank. Now, he's the Democrat from Massachusetts that chairs the House Financial Services Committee. He said, "We now have confirmation of two facts. One, the Federal Reserve System is not a strong advocate for consumers. And two, there is no Santa Claus. Kids who are listening, I have no idea why Barney Frank had to drag Santa into this. He was only kidding, of course."
All right. Well, you mentioned Santa Claus. One thing that Congress did put back into the stockings is it did come up with a fix for the alternative minimum tax. Now, what does the IRS do? Because they're really late on having to get this into the system, right?
Yeah, the IRS is not happy with Santa at all. The IRS says because Congress dithered back and forth, well, guess what? That's going to stall your refund. It could stall refunds for more than 15 million taxpayers. The IRS has said it needs about 7 weeks from the enactment of this legislation to adjust its computers to the change. So you're just going to have to wait for your refund.
All right, a bit of a lump of coal then. Thanks so much, Nancy.
You're welcome.
Nancy Marshall-Genzer, one of Santa's elves, joining us from our Washington, D.C. bureau.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thriven Financial for Lutherans, working to provide tools and expertise to help you meet your retirement goals and ultimately thrive in retirement. Let's thrive. On the web at thrivent.com/retirement. The Marketplace Entrepreneurship Desk is supported by the Kauffman Foundation, online at kauffman.org.
Nancy mentioned those so-called liar loans where borrowers could just state their income and get a mortgage. Often that meant the lender never even bothered to check out their credit score. As we all know, it's one of the most important numbers in our lives, and it's about to get an Oprah-style makeover. Here to talk about what's being called FICO 08 is our good friend Liz Pulliam-Weston. Liz, what is going on here?
Well, the Fair Isaac Corporation, which came up with the original FICO score and has been, you know, improving it all along, is doing a fairly major remodel that's supposed to come online next year. And what it's doing is kind of making a concession because it had come up with a better mousetrap, another credit scoring formula called the Next Gen that did things a lot better, or at least, you know, measurably better than the FICO score that everybody uses, but they couldn't get lenders to adopt it. Well, instead, they've decided to put the best improvements into the classic FICO score and call it FICO 08.
So what exactly are the improvements then?
Well, they're trying to dice things a little more finely, and how consumers are going to see it comes out in a number of ways. One is that if you have one serious problem with a lender, it's not going to tank your score as much as in the past. In the past, you know, the people that had one collection account, one 90-day late, something serious that happened, were kind of all lumped into the same category with people that had completely mishandled their credit and had dozens of delinquencies and all kinds of problems. Now it's going to take a better look at your whole situation.
So that's who it helps. Does it make it more difficult for anybody else?
I would pay attention to how much of your credit you're using because it seems to be more sensitive to how much of your available credit you're using on your credit cards, for example.
So that's, for example, if you have a $5,000 limit and you've bought $4,000 worth of stuff, that's high utilization.
Exactly. And you want to avoid that in any case. That's always been true. But it seems like they're making more of an effort, again, to distinguish between different groups. And one of the areas they're looking at is inquiries, how much credit you've gone after recently. The old scoring formula kind of looked at that as just a blanket negative. The more credit you went after, the worse it was for your score. They're realizing people are using credit differently. They're shopping more aggressively. You know, if they're going out for a loan, they're going to look at more than one place to get the loan that they want. They tend to change credit cards more frequently or have more credit cards. So now if you have a moderate amount of credit cards, you're not going to get hurt as bad. The issue is how you use the rest of your credit. So if you go out and you have, you know, if you've just applied for 5 new credit cards and you've maxed them all out, it's going to hurt you more than if you've applied for 5 credit cards and you only use 10 to 30% of your credit limits.
Does that then make it advantageous to close cards?
I don't think it ever will be advantageous to shut down credit cards. The problem is every time you close a credit account, it can't help your score and it may hurt it. Doesn't look like this new formula is going to change that.
So when might we all see this change that's coming from Fair Isaac?
Again, that's still up in the air. The original projection was it would be rolling out starting in the fall, this fall. And obviously that didn't happen. It looks like at least two of the bureaus will probably begin rolling it out in the spring. Not every lender is going to adopt it right away. What tends to happen when Fair Isaac makes a big change to the credit scoring formula is that it tends to get rolled out over time and different lenders adopt it at different times.
Okay. Liz Pulliam-Weston is a personal finance columnist with MSN. Thanks for coming in again.
Anytime, Tess.
And this is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. All right, our economics editor Chris Farrell is here for the audio op-ed that we call The Straight Story. And this week, Chris, I understand you are taking on the self-proclaimed madman of Wall Street, Jim Cramer?
Booyah!
I will take that as a yes. Cramer, of course, is the host of CNBC's stock-picking show Mad Money.
And I want to welcome him to the world of intelligent personal finance.
No way.
Oh, yeah. Now, it turns out, yes, he does throw tantrums on TV.
They know nothing! This is a different kind of market, and the Fed is asleep!
Booyah! And, of course, you know, he preaches the gospel of buying and selling stocks, but he's a different man on the printed page. I just read his book, Stay Mad for Life. Here's some of his advice. Invest for the long haul. Buy index funds. Diversify. You know, he sounds an awful lot like
you.
Exactly. So here's the straight story. Stock picking and rapid fire trading are fun, but trying to beat the market is hazardous to your wealth.
Hazardous to your wealth. Well done, my friend.
I had to do that again.
I have to ask, though. I mean, isn't Cramer a bit of a hypocrite here? I mean, saying one thing on TV and then another in his book.
Yes, he is. Now, in fairness to him, this is a fault line that runs throughout the financial world. There is a divide between the precepts of intelligent money management and commission-hungry Wall Street and entertainment value on television or in broadcasting or in print.
Right.
If you are constantly giving out just sort of sound, good advice, eventually you run out of stories. So,
except here on Marketplace Money.
Absolutely. And there's a reason why. Because we actually deal with real people's situation. The big myth out there is that good personal finance is boring. It's stories about people trying to manage their lives in this very difficult, complex world that we live in. But the easy money is to say, you know, buy this stock. Let's sell this stock. It's a lot of fun. It's entertainment, but it's not managing money.
All right. Well, how do we know what experts to trust, whether they're on TV or in a book?
Here's one of my standards. When I talk to really smart people on Wall Street, every single one of them, they will tell you, don't buy individual stocks. Don't try and do what I do. Don't try and do this rapid buying and selling. Diversify. Buy index funds and go enjoy your life.
Well, let's get down to brass tacks. Did you like the book?
You know, look, I like a lot of the advice in the book and how he has his story. You know, he still likes individual stocks, but he echoes Warren Buffett. He says, look, you want to buy individual stocks? You participate in the Wall Street conference calls. You read everything that the company files with the Securities and Exchange Commission. You follow the research reports. And if you're not willing to do that, then you go buy index funds. I like that. I think that's good. At the end, he has the 20 stocks that he really favors. He's got the 5 mutual funds that he really favors. That's fine with me. The book is okay, but the underlying advice, yes, I do like the underlying advice.
And the TV show?
I can't stand it. I can't stand
me
that show.
Either.
It drives me crazy. Now, I can understand, I guess some people like the flushing toilet and all the sound effects that go on there, but I have to turn it off. The only thing that I do watch it for a little bit, every once in a while when I'm flicking, I'm one of those people that does like to flick.
Yeah, you're a guy.
And I'm a guy. It's genetic. Is he going to explode? So there's this sort of, you know, train wreck aspect of it to it. But then I go, I can't listen to this, and people shouldn't be listening to this, and nobody should be buying and selling stocks based on what this man is saying. And I move on.
All right. The Straight Story from our economics editor, Chris Farrell. Chris, most happy holidays, and we'll check in with you again later in the show.
Booyah.
You land at an airport ready for a vacation, but your suitcase took the scenic route. What to do with you when your luggage goes AWOL? And tis the season for giving. Here's a guy who gave till it hurt.
We had disposable income of about $100. And my wife and I agreed, we're going to give this $100.
That's how it goes when you're tithing. It's all coming up on Marketplace Money from American Public Media. Yeah. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. I'm Tess Viglund. Like the holidays themselves, religion is really about spirituality, morality, the soul, not generally cash money. But it's not sacrilegious, I hope, to acknowledge that finance and faith do sometimes end up mixing. In fact, for some, it happens all year long. This year, reporter Cash Peters decided to explore the practice of tithing, and he found it might not be a bad investment.
So, okay, it sounds crazy, but I've decided to give away 10% of my income as a tithe. When you tithe, you're making a secret spiritual deal, apparently. It's a sort of special offer from the universe. You know, like when you buy a box of detergent and get one free. Ken Kraft.
There are laws that are just natural laws that we live by. There's a law of sowing and reaping. You sow an apple seed, you're going to reap more apples than you do the one seed you sow. And it's the same with finances. You know, when you give, it's given back to you.
See? I'm totally hooked. Ken runs the San Fernando Valley Mission, a homeless shelter in L.A. Unfortunately for him, though, tithing is not about giving to charity. Not according to Paul Kay of the website tithing.org, anyway.
Tithing, as we look at it, is giving back to the source of your spiritual teachings. You're not giving to a person, you're not giving to an organization. You are giving to God.
And for most people, I guess, that means they tithe to their place of worship. By the way, that's tax deductible. But it could be to anyone, really, who makes your life better. Here's the first problem, though. If I give 10% of my income away, won't, and stay with me here, won't I then be 10% poorer?
I would look at it as actually I'm richer than before I gave.
How are you richer then?
You're richer inwardly in terms of you're saying to yourself, I have enough to give. You're richer because you're giving.
Richer inwardly. Don't know if I like the sound of that. So rather than leap straight in, I decided to consult my friend, Len Richmond.
What are you going to get out of this? You already got what you wanted, so...
You're rewarded tenfold.
Are you really? Okay.
I have some very mercenary friends. The part of the tithing idea Len objected to was all of it, basically. But that's because he's never met Nick Siegel. Nowadays, Nick's a successful real estate guy in Brentwood, California. But years ago, he and his wife were almost insolvent.
We had disposable income of about $100. And my wife and I agreed, we're going to give this $100. And we're going to say, all right, we're at the bottom. So here we go. What do you got for us?
Then you got nothing, though.
We got nothing. That's right. But you're doing $100 and nothing. You're scraping the bottom. You can taste the pain on the bottom. What does it matter at that point, right?
Right. But that was 12 years ago. Now, I have no idea how rich he is, but he's rich. And it's all he believes because he tithed.
Things started to shift. Suddenly, there was a deal that where there wasn't a deal. And suddenly, I had a new client. And I was able to start to manifest money.
What you'll find when you speak to people who genuinely do that, they go, I don't know how it happened. I thought I was going to be poor, but in fact, after I gave my 10%, I had all the money I needed to pay my expenses. This is a common, common experience among people who tithe.
It's a con job. How are they going to confirm you're going to be rewarded for something? There's no way you can confirm it, so they're conning you by giving you something that you can never verify.
Oh, dear. Well, I know it's a little too mystical for most people and doesn't make strict practical sense, but if only to feel richer inwardly, I decided to give it a go anyway.
How can you be so dumb?
Be quiet. I tithed 3 separate times in 10 days. I gave the money cheerfully. That's important. You mustn't resent the giving, even if you secretly do. I gave away 10% of any financial increase I received, not just my income. Paul Kay.
I actually tithed on the gifts. Someone fortunately gave me a little nano iPod the other day. Complete surprise.
Gave away the earphones.
Yes, that's my giving. So I looked it up and I said, how much is this? This is $200. So I'm tithing $20 on it.
Good. And last of all, I gave the money to my local church. That's it. Then I sat back and waited for the money to roll in.
There oftentimes is a monetary reward, but there oftentimes isn't. But there is always a reward, and you have to look around and find out what that reward is.
And you know what? He's right. I didn't receive money. There were rewards, though. For a start, over the next week, friends kept buying me free meals. It was so strange. Plus, my dentist dispensed with an expensive treatment, saving me $5,000. And I was about to buy a $2,000 sauna for the house when, out of the blue, somebody else paid for it as a gift. All within 6 days. Coincidence? Who cares? All I know is I'm addicted to tithing now.
How can you be so dumb?
You stop saying that. And I'm going to keep doing it till I'm as rich as Nick Siegel, or until I, too, live at the San Fernando Valley Homeless Shelter. On Easy Street, for now, I'm Cash Peters for Marketplace Money.
Keep it up, Cash. If you want to hear more about how to give, next week we're devoting the entire show to the more generous side of personal finance, philanthropy. If you are among the 47 million people crowding into the cattle cars we call airplanes this holiday season, here's a piece of advice. Pack light so you can carry on your bags. If you don't, you might land in New York, but your bags could wind up somewhere in Kansas. If that happens, what do? Max out your credit cards, buy a whole new wardrobe? Not a good idea, and maybe not necessary. Anne Banas is with SmarterTravel.com. And what's the right thing to do first?
If your bag is checked and it's lost, what you'll have to do is file a claim with the airline. And at that point, you can get up to $3,000 for what's in your bag. The only problem with that is it's a depreciated value, and there's no guarantee they're going to give you that much. That's just the cap.
Is this something where you have to prove exactly what you lost and what was in your bag? I mean, should you take photos of what's in your bag before you go?
From my understanding, basically all you need to do is document the items in your suitcase as you're filing your claim. I mean, documentation's always going to help if you have receipts, but from what I understand, it's not necessary.
Is there any chance that your own insurance, like your house insurance, would cover any part of this?
Yeah, actually, my advice is always to file a claim with the airline first and see how much you'll get back. But, you have some other options. Your homeowner's insurance might cover it. And because airlines won't cover certain items like jewelry, electronics, you can also take out additional insurance policy for that.
The airline won't cover electronics and jewelry? The most expensive items that you would have?
They're very crafty, aren't they? Yeah. I don't know the exact reason why they won't cover it. They just, refuse to be liable for items like that. So you're pretty much on your own.
And what if it's technically lost on your flight, but then it gets there a couple of days later? Is that something where you get any sort of recompense from the airlines, even though you got your bag back?
Technically, the airlines don't have any rules that say that they have to reimburse you at that point. But it's good for consumers to know that if you ask, there is a possibility you'll get some kind of reimbursement, usually in the form of a stipend per day, usually around $25 per day until your bag is found, up to 5 days.
Oh, so $25 will go a long way toward getting me some clothes and underwear and all my toiletries and...
Exactly. But, it's really good to know that the airlines won't guarantee that. But if you don't ask, it's not going to happen.
All right. So also bring some emergency cash with you just in case you get
so a good idea. Always a good idea.
All right. I suppose that the best way to avoid any of this is to always bring a carry-on bag, but that's not always possible.
Right. And carry-on baggage is getting more and more complicated. Everyone knows the liquids rule where you have to keep everything in small 3-ounce containers.
And God help you if it's 3.5 ounces.
Oh, no. Yeah, it gets thrown out. I mean, sometimes you can slip by, but you never want to take that chance, especially at this time of year when you're going through security and the lines are going to be horrendous.
Have you ever had your own luggage lost?
I've been pretty lucky, so I'm going to knock on wood.
All right. Anne Banas is the executive editor at SmarterTravel.com. Thanks for helping us out.
Thanks for having me.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thriven Financial for Lutherans, working to provide tools and expertise to help you meet your retirement goals and ultimately thrive in retirement. Let's thrive. On the web at thrivent.com/retirement. Sustainability coverage is supported in part by the Candida Sustainability Fund of the Tides Foundation, furthering values that contribute to a healthy planet.
And now it's time to get personal. That's when we find out what kind of money questions are on your mind. And with me, as always, is our economics editor, Chris Farrell. Hey, Chris.
Hey, Tess.
You ready for some more calls?
Absolutely.
Well, our first call concerns something we've been talking about a lot on this show. Fran is with us from Claremont, California. Hi, Fran.
Hi.
What do you do there in Claremont?
I'm a teacher.
What age?
Elementary school.
Oh, how fun.
Yeah, it's great.
Well, what's your question for Chris today?
Well, I'm wondering, about 2 years ago, I bought a home, and I put down about 20%. I got a good interest rate, but I wasn't able to afford a regular 30-year fixed monthly payment. So I got a no-interest, or rather interest-only loan, and I've been able to make the payments. But now my question is, I'm beginning to wonder, should I start to worry? Am I a part of this subprime stuff that's going on, and I'm just too blissfully ignorant to know?
That's an interesting question, Chris. And, you know, this is something that has come up. We've talked about it even just in the last couple of weeks, which is, how do you know whether you have a subprime loan? What are kind of the markers of a subprime? What are some tips for Fran?
Well, a number of the markers for subprime loans is a bad credit score, putting down little to almost nothing in terms of the loan, not having any income documentation, and getting a higher than market interest rate than you could get if you put down 20%.
So it doesn't sound like she's in that category.
However, she has an interest-only mortgage. The problem with interest-only mortgages is that, as the name tells you, none of your money is going to the principal, then it's going to reset. In today's market, your rate would pretty much double. So I would be using this time to shop around and get yourself a better mortgage. If you have lots of questions to ask, there are a number of nonprofit counselors through the U.S. Department of Housing, Urban Development, or through the Home Ownership Preservation Foundation. Those are two sources that will give you accredited nonprofit counselors in your area.
But Chris, to her main question, it doesn't sound like she has a subprime mortgage, right?
No, it's not a subprime mortgage, but it's a warning mortgage. New term, just made it up. But it is a mortgage that, where a lot of problems are concentrated, are in the interest-only loan market. However, having put down the amount that she put down and being able to meet her payments with no problem, none of the, you know, typical warning bells are going off for a lot of people who are really strained. But I don't like interest-only loans, and I think the goal would be to get out of it before it resets to a much higher rate.
Right.
All right. Does that help you out, Fran?
It certainly does. Thank you so much.
Terrific. Thanks for the call. Well, do you need your own financial definition? Think of us as a kind of dictionary. Look us up on our website. We're at marketplace.org and click on the Getting Personal link, or give us a call. We're at 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONEY. All right, let's dip into the email bag. And our next question is from Sarah, who lives in Grafton, Wisconsin. She has been noticing in the rental listings in her local paper a lot of interesting ads, Chris. They claim that you can take over someone else's mortgage payments without a credit check, no down payment, and you only pay the remaining balance, and the title is transferred to you. My friend, I'm guessing this is a bit of a scam.
Every warning bell is going off on this. I mean, what there is out there, and there's a discussion, this thing called assumable mortgages, where a buyer can assume the mortgage of the seller. Now, there's a couple of problems with this. With your traditional 30-year fixed-rate mortgages, since the early, mid-1980s, essentially those mortgages have not been assumable. Some adjustable-rate mortgages are assumable, but the bank's still going to require that you do a credit check, and they're going to review the circumstances. This is a scam. Run. Don't bother to read it. Just turn the page and pick up something else in the paper to peruse.
All right, Sarah, I recommend the crossword. All right, Patrick emailed us from Winchester, Massachusetts, and he has about $12,000 in one college loan. And with the 10-year payment plan that he's on, he says he's going to wind up paying almost double that amount because of interest. He thinks he can squeeze together $5,000 to $10,000 right now. He wants it to go to the principal. But he's heard a lot of horror stories about people paying off their college loans in advance. So is this possible for him to do? Is it a good idea, a bad idea?
Oh, it's a great idea. Now, with student loans, there is no prepayment penalty. So you can pay off early. What he can do is, when he makes that extra payment, he says, I want this to go to principal only. And then if he goes to FinAid, Bankofamerica.org. They have a prepayment calculator there. It's very good.
Oh.
So he can also play around with some numbers because he's got quite a range there, Tess, between $5,000 and $10,000. But it's wonderful to pay it off early. And the only reason why I sometimes recommend people not pay it off early is if they're going to strain their budget so greatly that they get themselves into other types of financial trouble, like taking on credit card debt.
All right. Well, there you go. Hope that helps out. And if you think you've got a good idea, give us a call and find out whether you should go ahead with it or go back to the drawing board. Our phone number is 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONEY. And now we're answering your questions every weekday online at marketplace.org. Just click on the Getting Personal link and stay tuned for more Getting Personal later in the show. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. Finish your holiday shopping yet? Sick of people talking about holiday shopping yet? Well, sorry, we're a personal finance show, and folks tend to finance gifts this time of year, whether they can afford it or not. The good news, the season is almost at an end. But if you've got some last-minute buys to make, we know someone with suggestions. On this week's A Day in the Work Life, we meet a woman who stocks the gift store at a New York institution you may have heard of.
This pearl necklace by Paola Volpi. It's actually an electrician's wire. Beautiful to wear, but a really innovative material at the same time.
My name is Che Costello Sosin. I'm 31 years old, and I'm a product manager at the Museum of Modern Art.
There's somebody wearing one of our jackets. That looks great. Sorry. I knew I was interested in a career in the arts. And when I heard that there was such a thing as a buyer or product developer that works at a museum, I thought it was just a really interesting job. Like, wow, you're working in the arts, but you're still really involved in this dynamic world of products and business. So I started really entry level and worked my way up. There's a lot of traditional ways people go about, like, you know, traditional retailers go about finding products, like trade shows and things like that. We go out and try to find non-traditional sources, really small designers, people other people haven't met before in out-of-the-way places.
I've been to London, I've been to Paris, I've been to Berlin and Frankfurt, Italy, Japan. I think that's it.
I think when I first started traveling, I mean, from having worked at MoMA for a really long time, I thought I really understood what the aesthetic was and what it was about. But then when you actually travel and you meet the people and you see them, you see this whole nother part of it. The first time I went to France, I met Marianne Olry, this jewelry designer, and she has this tiny little garret on the 7th floor walk-up in Paris. And she's got, like, these silicone molds, and she's pouring resin into them by hand. And understanding why, when I was calling her on the phone, being like, Marianne, we desperately needed 50 more in a month. Can't you get them for us? And she was like, no. Why? She couldn't do it, because there she is alone pouring it into the molds. It was just a revelation.
The range for a buyer in New York City can go anywhere from $30,000 to $80,000 a year, and MoMA salaries do fall within that range. In addition, we get really excellent benefits.
I have so many samples in my office, it's incredible. I just got back from a trip to Europe. I was begging all these designers, get me in these samples, I need them because we're styling out our spring catalog. They did their job. I'm taking all these packages, I'm opening them, and there is an avalanche, literally like an avalanche of all of my different papers and my samples, everything. Everybody came running. They're like, are you alive in there? One thing that I was really excited about the first time I saw it, we were in a tiny store in Japan. It was a briefcase that was made of wood. And we brought it into our store, and it was expensive for us. I didn't know if our customers were going to buy them, but it was such a beautiful product, and it was one of my best sellers that season. I was just so happy that the customer got it, and when you finally see, like, somebody walking down the street with it, it's like it came to life. It's like alive.
A Day in the Work Life was reported by Julie Miller. Coming up, young professionals may know their favorite happy hour drink, but ask them to choose an investment and...
It's kind of like picking from a picture book. It's just like what looks good. I don't really know what is what.
Look at no-hassle mutual funds for young investors. You're listening to Marketplace Money from American Public Media. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. I'm Tess Vigeland. Remember getting your first credit card? What? Plastic that lets me buy anything and a Visa t-shirt? I'm in. But you probably don't remember your first 401k asset allocation. That's because most young people, well, they're not exactly thinking about retirement. But these days, mutual funds are doing everything they can to ease young investors into building a sound portfolio. Investors like Alex Schmidt.
My 27th birthday was in February. I didn't keep track of how much cash I dropped that night partying at a bar. But apparently, people my age should have one eye on the register. Here's Steve McLean from American Century Investments.
At the 27 age point, they really start to understand that they need a plan for the future and establish some key goals and start to go after them.
Not so much in my case. My parents really never talked to me about investing, so I have goals, like I want a house someday, but I've really never thought about the money it'll take to get there. Still, lots of funds these days are trying to tell me I can get ahead by investing, and they also want me to know how, like, super-duper quick and easy it is for a young person to get started. There's the 15-minute IRA from Charles Schwab, the Simple Start IRA from Fidelity, and yes, American Century Investments has one too, the My Whatever Plan. That's what it's called.
So here's the deal. My Whatever Plan makes it super easy to get started. Get a plan for the things that matter to you now. A new car, your first house, travel, whatever.
The My Whatever Plan pictures its target audience, me, as follows. I'm young, just starting out, so I have some cash, but not a lot. Retirement seems like it's really far away, and I feel like maybe I should invest, but I'm hazy about how. Their answer? A fund with a low minimum investment, only $500 compared with $3,000 the grown-up funds require. And the site has big text and graphics. Steve McLean again.
We really believe that making it simple for them is key. If it's too difficult or too intimidating, we really believe it will turn them off.
Thanks for the vote of confidence, Steve. But I don't want it so simple that the site leaves out key information. I had Mayor Statman, an economics professor at Santa Clara University, inspect the seemingly simple My Whatever Plan site.
I had to scroll down to really to the small print to find those expenses.
And there are expenses. No transaction fees, as the site claims, but there are maintenance fees, and they're as much as 1%. Statman says mutual funds teach people to save, and that's good, but they have to be forthcoming.
The question is it presented properly with full, frank information for young people to make decisions, and especially for young people who are less sophisticated? It is really important for mutual fund companies to be paternalistic.
Okay, yes. A parental figure you can trust is key, but these sites aren't that. You can log on and start up a fund without asking one question or getting a single piece of advice. Not exactly model parenting. Steve McLean from American Century Investments claims young people ask the questions they need to. But do they? I've come here to the very same kind of bar where I had my birthday to find out what other people my age are doing.
I think I have stocks from my bar mitzvah.
Actually, my mother-in-law used to work with CDs and stuff, so she just said that was the best way to go.
And when you picked your CD, how'd you know which one to pick?
Oh, she picked it for me.
In reality, it's kind of like picking out of, it's just like, you know, picking from a picture book. It's just like what looks good. I don't really know what what is what?
Are you worried that, like, you know, these funds and things that you're invested in what? Are taking high fees from you? How much are they charging you? Do you know?
I actually don't know.
So here's my assessment. A lot of people my age don't think about investing. And the ones that do aren't doing all the research about what it takes to start a fund. Mayor Statman again.
One of the things young people have to learn is to be smart shoppers in everything, including financial products. And one of the things to learn about financial products is that they come with fees, and those fees vary from fund to fund.
Even the most forthcoming funds won't tell you to price shop, and that's not their job. That is mom and dad's job. So consider this a PSA to all parents and kids. Talk to each other about investing. If you don't expect a mutual fund website to do it for you. In Los Angeles, I'm Alex Schmidt for Marketplace Money.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, working to provide tools and expertise to help you meet your retirement goals and ultimately thrive in retirement. Let's thrive on the web at thrivent.com/retirement. And by Reuters, delivering news and information that reaches over a billion people every day. Before it's news, it's Reuters. And by FINRA Investor Education Foundation, helping inform today's investor through innovative grant-making and educational funding. Online at finrafoundation.org.
We're back again with Getting Personal, and as usual, I'm joined by Chris Farrell, our personal finance expert, and our next caller situation is shared by millions of parents all over the world. Greg is calling from Pottsville, Pennsylvania, and Greg, why don't you tell us a little bit about what's going on here?
Hello. We have a child, a special needs child. He's been diagnosed with autism about 7 years ago. He's 10 now. And then about 3 years ago, he decided that it was just, you know, not enough. So he decided he's going to also have diabetes.
Oh, boy.
And that's insulin dependent. So we've been, of course, you know, dealing with everything, you know, medically and such. And I was listening to his show the other week, and all of a sudden I realized that we basically don't have really a strategy for, financial strategy for our son. What's going to happen when he's 18.
So you're not just talking about health coverage. You're talking about, you know, how to set him up for his life.
Well, yeah.
So what kind of research have you done already in terms of what kind of money and how you can set that aside for your son?
As far as what we've done with the money itself, when he was born, I put $1 in a bank on the day he was born. And since then, I've been basically putting that in every day.
Just in a regular savings account?
Exactly, yeah.
Okay.
We know you shop around online and get a better deal and you move around money so you get your better interest. But, you know, it's still not a viable strategy, I realized.
Mm-hmm.
And I started looking at estate planning.
Right.
Yes.
And as far as I understand, and that's something I really didn't understand completely yet. But looks like we're going to have to figure out some kind of a trust for him.
What about health coverage? What kind of coverage does your son currently have and might he be able to carry through in adulthood?
And I guess that's another question. Right now, there is health coverage from the state because of his disability.
And probably when he turns 18, he won't be eligible for that anymore, I would guess.
Well, I mean, as of right now, he might be, but they might change the laws.
Sure. All right, Chris, tough question, but certainly one that lots of parents have to face. So what's the best way to get started in terms of setting aside a nice pot of money for their child?
Well, I think Greg's already doing a lot of the research and important work. Greg, you mentioned a trust, and I think the type of trust in your circumstances that really does work the best and is designed for the circumstances you're facing is what's called a special needs trust. And what a special needs trust allows you to do, just in general, is set money aside for your child. And as your child gets older and the money can grow and compound and you can have a lot of different investments in there, so hopefully some of the money grows over a period of time, the special needs trust is truly designed for people in your circumstance. My real caveat to the special needs trust is you need to work with a lawyer who does this routinely. It's like when we go to the doctor and you have heart trouble, you want that heart surgeon that does nothing but heart surgery, because if it's not set up right, it will blow up in your face. The other thing is one of my favorite organizations in this area is called The ARC, and their website is thearc.org. And they have by various states what are the public programs available to you.
So that trust, I would be able to have basically some kind of mutual fund attached to that somehow, right?
Absolutely.
Okay.
All right, Greg, does that give you a place to start?
Yes, very much so. I really appreciate it. And also, if I may say, you have a lovely show. I've been listening to it almost religiously on a weekly basis.
Well, thanks so much for listening, and thanks for the call.
Thank you very much for taking it.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
All right, well, those are all the questions we can take on this week's show, but Chris is now answering your personal finance questions online every weekday. Just visit our website, we're at marketplace.org, and click on the Getting Personal link. You can also call us at 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONEY. Chris, thanks for the great advice as always.
Thanks a lot, Tess.
They say you should never look a gift horse in the mouth. What does that mean, anyway? Well, as we enter this week of gift giving and receiving, we acknowledge that sometimes the horse leaves a present you just don't want. If you end up returning a gift this year, Greg Doherty of Consumer Reports says you will not be alone.
We did a poll recently and found that about a third of people expected to be returning something this year, which jibes with other figures we've seen of about 40% of people who take back one or more gifts. So it's a lot of people.
In other words, prepare for long lines at the return counter, and you may have to pay for that privilege.
Some stores have restocking fees, and traditionally it's been electronics, but we're finding it's spreading to other departments of the store as well. So don't be surprised if they charge you something, even if you've not even taken it out of the box.
There is a way to make sure all of this goes a bit more smoothly. Gift givers should be sure to hang on to receipts or ask for a gift receipt at the register.
We've heard of retailers, including some of the big chains that have computer systems that will monitor how many things you take back. You might be able to take back one or two things without a receipt, but any more than that, then you may be flagged. They're concerned about people shoplifting stuff and then bringing it back for a refund, but we're finding a lot of consumers who just didn't bother to hang on to the receipt are falling into that trap.
And a final word of advice, check the store's return policy, because some sellers require returns within 14 days of purchase. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. The mantra in investing this year was head outside the U.S., let at least a little of your money swim in the highly profitable waters of, say, India or China. China's gross domestic product is growing at some 11.5%. But if you haven't yet dipped your toe, there may still be time. Burton Malkiel of A Random Walk Down Wall Street fame has a new book out this week. It's called From Wall Street to the Great Wall, and he joins us now. So what attracts you most to the Chinese economy?
China is simply the most remarkable growth story in the world. There is no country in history that has grown at such a sustained high rate.
So you argue that this boom will continue. There are rumblings out there, though, even today, that China's economy is essentially in a bubble, not unlike that of the housing market here in the U.S., and that it's got to burst. What do you say to that?
There are certainly some risks, and there are many people who think that it's near bubble levels. But the reason that I think the growth is going to continue is that thus far, almost all of the growth in China has been in the eastern part of the country. The cities like Shanghai and Shenzhen. Very little of that growth has come to the center and the western part of the country. And in order to build, as the Chinese like to say, a harmonious society, their goal is actually a quadrupling of per capita income in China by the year 2020. And I think that as that growth goes to the center and western part of the country, there are ample resources, and in particular with an educated labor force, to keep that growth going for many years to come.
It was fascinating reading your book to learn how different China's market functions are from the traditional markets that we all know, including the U.S. market. Tell us a little bit more about what is unique about China's market versus other markets in developed countries.
Well, there are a number of things that are unique. the local shares are, with very limited exceptions, only available for local Chinese citizens. However, they have taken some of their best companies and they let them list in Hong Kong. Now, Hong Kong is part of China, but in fact, it's under a separate administration, and it has a currency that is exchangeable into other currencies of the world, and it has a stock market that is available not to local Chinese, but available to Hong Kong citizens, and more importantly, available to citizens in the United States and other countries.
Can you give us a couple of real-world examples so that people kind of get these names in their heads? Would one be, for example, Baidu, which is China's version of Google?
Yeah, China's Google, China Life, which is the biggest life insurance company in China, Sinopec, which is an oil and chemical company. The funny thing is, in 2006, the Shanghai Stock Exchange complained to the government that you're letting the best companies go and list abroad, and we want Shanghai to be the financial capital of Asia. So you've got to let them list in Shanghai as well. So now companies like China Life list in Hong Kong, New York, and Shanghai. And here's where it gets dicey. Because the local Chinese have no other places to put their money, they have bid up the prices to what people like Greenspan and Buffett think are unreasonable levels. And I think so, too, because China Life has been selling between 50 and 75% higher per share than the same prices of the same stocks in Hong Kong and New York.
So that kind of thing obviously contributes to why Chinese stocks are so volatile. You just have huge swings up and down. How does that volatility then play if you have that within your portfolio?
It plays in the following way. Sometimes you can add to your portfolio something which in itself is very risky, but as long as that volatility tends to be uncorrelated with what may be in the core of your portfolio, the paradox is that you can sometimes add volatile stocks to your portfolio, which will reduce the risk of the portfolio. And the reason is, if they tend to zig when the rest of your portfolio zags, it could actually smooth out the total volatility of your portfolio. Because sure, some of your investments might be made when stocks are sky high, but some of them might be made also after a time when they suffer a severe setback.
Burton Malkiel is the author, along with Patricia Taylor, of From Wall Street to the Great Wall. Sir, thank you so much for coming in. It's been a pleasure talking to you.
It has been a pleasure talking to you, Tess.
And stay tuned in a few weeks. Professor Malkiel will walk us step by step through the best ways to invest in China. And that's Marketplace Money for this week. Next time, one anonymous donor gives away thousands of dollars each year, never forgetting her own struggles as a single mother.
I do recall the one night where I had to decide whether I could buy tuna fish or diapers.
A look at the philanthropists among us. Marketplace Money is produced by John Haas with Rico Galliano, Stephen Hoffman, James Richter, and the rest of the Marketplace staff. Our theme was composed by Mark Governor. The executive producer of the program is J.J. Yore. Remember, talk to your own expert before you make any big money decisions. I'm Tess Vigeland. Very happy holidays, and we'll see you next week.
Want to hear something on Marketplace Money again? Help is as near as your home computer. To find audio archives of past programs and information on transcripts, just go to the Internet and log on to our website. The information you need when you need it is only a few clicks away. Just point your browser to marketplace.org. Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans,
working to provide tools and expertise to help you meet your retirement goals and ultimately thrive in retirement. Let's thrive. On the web at thrivent.com/retirement.
American Public Media.